morning and welcome to Family Life, your host, Selena Muhammad, and Dr. Nadia Muhammad. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent, Murad Speaks. Bismillah, Rahman, Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. I greet the listening audience in the peace. Assalamu alaikum. This week's discussion, Family Life, Sheikh Muhammad Ibn Hisham Jabir is honoring us with his presence again. This is part two. And Sheikh Jabir is a forensic historian with a special interest in Islamic, African, and American history. He is a lifetime student of knowledge with more than 50 years of combined research, training, and practical experience in Arabic, Islamic studies, history, leadership, and dawah. He is the author of Color Me Muslim and the director of many historical forums such as 75 Years of Islam, Muslims of the African Diaspora, Children of Abraham Lost in History, and From Malcolm X to El-Hajj El-Malik Shabazz. He is a graduate of the 1978 Muhammad bin Saud Imam Training Seminary in Naperville, Illinois. Sheikh Jabir is also a graduate of Arabic Language Institute of Fez, Morocco, and Jannatul Mawwa of Cairo, Egypt, currently holding a BA in Arabic Language Systems. Welcome again, Sheikh Jabir. We also have a special guest who will be contributing to our added questions this week. And this is Fatima Ali, DIY home improvement entrepreneur and the daughter of Hadia Alameen Muhammad, Sister Alice OX, and Abdullah Muhammad, Robert 7X, the entrepreneur of Building Bridges, a DIY 365 online YouTube home improvement program launching in the near future. To my guests, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Assalamu alaikum. Thank you for having me again, Sister Salima. Very honored to be here today.
You are so welcome. You're both welcome. Sheikh Jabir, let's begin where we left off last week. Islam in North America, back to the 20s and 30s, and the significance of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Malcolm X, born from the Nation of Islam, created a separate state. Your father, the late Hajj Hisham Jabir, may Allah be pleased with him, and our brother who performed the final funeral rites of Malcolm X, Al-Hajj El-Malik Shabazz. Last week, we stopped off with that topic. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad released a comment during the passing of Malcolm X, Al-Hajj El-Malik Shabazz. May Allah be pleased with him. Can you go into those comments?
Yes. Jabir? Yes. Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. When we look at the climate in which Malcolm was operating in the very last months of his life, as we know, it was a very hostile climate, and it gave the opposition, the hidden opposition, an opportunity to capitalize on that conflict or that those opposing views from the Nation of Islam and Malcolm's new venture. And that's something that's very important when we look at the climate, because as we know, there were three distinct agencies who had no love for the Nation of Islam, and we know that the Nation of Islam definitely were at odds, you know, by virtue of doctrine and their vision against these particular law enforcement agencies, such as the FBI, BOSS, the Bureau of Special Services, you know, operating out of New York, and also the NYPD. So we know they were looking for a golden opportunity to silence, you know, or to inhibit the growth and expansion of that particular organization. And lo and behold, as we can witness today, when Malcolm defected from the Nation of Islam, and the people that were in the high positions, you know, resented that. They had a certain amount of enmity in their hearts and animosity against Malcolm, and they began to operate, you know, on their own to try to reconcile that particular problem. You know, they had their own positions, their own establishment, and not only Malcolm defecting from the Nation of Islam was a problem, but also it was affecting some of the institutions, some of the mosques and temples that was across America, because a lot of these people were actually very affectionate towards Malcolm in his early stages. So, of course, you know, when the assassination of Haji Malik Shabazz occurred, the finger would be definitely pointed towards the Nation of Islam as an institution, despite the fact that, and I want to make a disclaimer here. When I use the term Elijah Muhammad, it's not a term of disrespect. I was orientated from the Adinu Lahi University Arabic Association. I come from a different school, and when I say this, it's of course of no disrespect, because I know that those people who have come through that process, through that orientation, are still, you know, honor him, and they use the title to honor Elijah Muhammad. And it's more of habit with me when I use this term. So I just wanted to make that disclaimer that it's no term of disrespect to that particular organization and those people who have affiliation with it. So I just want to make that clear. I should have did that the last time, but we were rushing through a lot of issues. But, okay, getting back on track. So definitely we know that it's on record. He instructed, you know, his ministers not to put their hands on Malcolm, not to touch Malcolm. And he had hopes himself, as he mentioned, that Malcolm would return, that he would return back, that he would run his course and he would return. And he did not look at him as an enemy or someone that could actually dismantle what he had built. Like I said, it was more on an isolated situation where people felt that their position or their institution was threatened. And we must realize that Malcolm was a very prolific, dynamic, charismatic speaker. And of course, when he defected from the Nation of Islam, many people followed him. You know, they followed him to the point that he established the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, you know. And something very unique about that establishment is that when he established the Muslim Mosque Incorporated, at that particular point, he had not denounced the teachings of Elijah Muhammad. He was still consistent with that particular doctrine. So a lot of people, it was just a matter of choice of leadership, okay? It was a matter of leadership. And again, as they began to point the finger at the Nation of Islam as an institution, as being responsible for the deaths of Malcolm, it created a problem. And Elijah Muhammad, under an interview, a very scrutinized, critical interview, made it plain. You know, he showed his regrets, and, you know, as a man of firmness, he did admit that Malcolm had strayed and that what had occurred to Malcolm was consequences of his own actions. It had nothing to do with the institution of the Nation of Islam. And many other people said that they would have carried out that particular task out of just love and affection, and the fact that they felt he had disrespected Elijah Muhammad to the point that he deserved what came to him. So, but it is clear that the institution, the Nation of Islam, as you know, as an institution, as an organization, definitely was hands-off on that situation. And even the people, at least one of the persons who are who was convicted and admitted himself said he did it because of a level of affection, that he felt that it was the right thing to do. And this was from a low-level area. And it's important that we understand that because we have the press, the media, films, and all these types of documents coming out without proper information, you know, taking bits and pieces without verifying and going to the sources, then we can actually recreate a hostile environment. We can actually bring people back to visit that, and we begin to push and pull and take sizes, and it caused us to take steps back, you know, in our progress, in our plight, and that's very important that we understand the facts and that we talk to the people and what is reliable, you know. As I mentioned earlier, you know, you have BOSI, which is the Bureau of Special Services, the NYPD, the FBI, and also the CIA. All of these organizations and legal law enforcement agencies were definitely anti-black progress, for better terms of words. Anything that opposed the system to be, especially Jim Crow legislation that was state-supported, met with consequences. And it didn't start with Malcolm, you know, and it didn't end with Malcolm. You know, we know Mega Evers and many more, and Dr. King a year later, you know. So you have to be fortified within an environment that, you know, you could actually navigate and protect yourself, and you have to really use strategy and understand the protocol, you know, of the society in which you were living in. And unfortunately, when you break these rules and transgress what the law enforcement consider a national threat, then they find ways and means to eliminate you.
Yes, and we're not placing, you know, as a disclaimer, any blame on any specific organization, but certainly their involvement and their involvement during that climate, during that time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that that's very poignant. And we, you know, Sheikh Jaber, you mentioned we don't want to go backwards in our progress. We want to continue going forward, so these facts versus fiction becomes very imperative.
I have a question.
Fatima Ali, Fatima, just give me a second here.
Okay.
Because I just want to explain, you know, what the brother just said. We are going to open up the floor, and I'll cue you when I want you to come in.
Okay, very good.
So go ahead, Fatima, with your question, because I know you have one regarding this subject matter. You may proceed.
Okay, thank you. So, yes, my question is this. Do you think the Nation of Islam was formulated, and this is just, I want you to, from a historical perspective, was formulated as a fundamentalist group, which I don't think it is, but I want your opinion, to a fundamentalist black organization as an antidote against white supremacy?
Well, that's a very, very good question, and I want to keep these two questions in mind because I want to come back and address something that Sister Salima said, very profound. You know, if you go back, we have to actually, you know, address things at their particular place and time, periodically, how things unfolded in America. If you go back into the, you know, we're talking about people who were descendants of ex-slaves. You could not be anything but black. They wouldn't allow you to be anything but a Negro. They had socially classified you in a category that levied restrictions upon you. So, you know, I think that all the organizations from Marcus Garvey to Morris Sion Temple to the Nation of Islam, the Dinu-Lahi University of Irish, these were survival methods. Okay, these were survival methods to throw off the cloak of oppression. And it was obvious that the white society or the powers that be at that particular time had no interest in empowering or restoring people of color back to their, you know, their state of humanity, whether it was economically, whether it was socially, whether it was, anyway. So, and just by trying to to recapture or identify your humanity was a problem, because we got to realize that the Jim Crow legislation was, you know, and I think that just by, if you have just organized a bridge club, it was all blacks, because, you know, we're talking about segregation, you know, and we're also talking about the anti-miscegenation laws that prohibited interracial marriages. So, I mean, the system was fixed that all of these groups was responsive groups. These were survival groups. And the Nation of Islam was not, in its initial platform, designed to be an extremist organization. It was an organization that saw that if people of color did not fend for themselves, did not, you know, take care of their own problems, their own needs, and so forth, then, of course, they would have perished, you know, as opposed to Marcus mm-hmm. Garvey, who had already recognized the problem at a very early stage and said, well, you know, his assessment, there was no hope for people of color in America after the Emancipation Proclamation. So he advocated Pan-Africanism, at least going back to the place of your beginning and start there. The organization that I come from, the AAUAA, made a migration. You know, they attempted to make a migration out of America because of the racial and discrimination and the oppressive laws that was inhibiting their growth. So they tried to make a migration to Turkey. However, Turkey was in worse conditions than America, so eventually they lost hope and they came back. So yes, and no, sisters, to answer the question, I do not think that the NOI, the Nation of Islam, in its very initial stages of development, was an extremist organization, a rigid anti-American. I think it was pro-human, pro-humanity. And I think that the forces on the outside caused it to escalate to where in we had, you know, they had to verbally, you know, saying, state their opinion, because you're talking about the 30s and early 40s wherein, you know, you could not actually rebuttal, you know, the white society. If you said anything anti and against, there was repercussions and reprisals that you would face. So it was a certain boldness. And I think when I look at Malcolm on the soapbox in Harlem, I think it's a certain boldness to get the message out. And I think that the place and time in which he chose to deliver that message in the northern region gave him a little longevity, because as we know, if he was in the southern states, Georgia, Mississippi, and all these North Carolina, then definitely they would have been some real resistance there. I mean, and so yes, I know. I don't think that it was a organization designed as a rigid anti-hate group, but I think that the powers that be forced the narrative to come out as a defense.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, because I think a lot of folks misunderstand, you know, the origins of the Nation of Islam. Why did they come about, and, you know, the pathway that it was looking to aspire to. So thank you for answering that question, because I face, you know, and confront folks all the time who says, well, it was a fundamentalist organization, sort of to rebut white supremacy, and it wasn't really founded in the principles of, you know, Islam. And I, you know, have to sometimes challenge that sort of perspective. So that's why I wanted to sort of you to expound on that, because, of course, Malcolm was a part of that organization. And then, of course, when he, you know, went and took Hajj, that perspective sort of shifted. And, of course, the break sort of happened at that point. And I just wanted some clarification on that, because from a historical perspective, because I don't think Malcolm was really breaking from sort of the principles of necessarily what the Nation was trying to expound, which is black empowerment. I mean, that's really what the basis of it was, in my view, one of them. And I think, you know, I think that was a lot of confusion. And as it relates to how did they bring in the faith, and so that's why I wanted you to answer that question. So thank you.
And I'd like to just tag something on that before we release that question altogether. You know, I think that just coming back to your humanity creates a problem as a person of color. You know, I mean, you couldn't be nothing but a fundamentalist, because you were nobody in their eyes. You see, and I think that it's the media and the press that has blown this thing all out of proportion. But any group, you know, any group at that time, you know what I'm saying, whether it was social, political, economic, that tried to actually empower their people, you see, became an oppositionist. You know, we call them terrorists today. They call them militants at that particular time. But it's just opposition, and people wanted to maintain their sovereignty over a people. And again, you know, that's a very misunderstood narrative that's out there about these early groups that was trying to bring about black empowerment. And you have to build your own schools because there was segregation. You have to have your own restaurants because you weren't allowed to eat. You have to have your own bus companies. And we had accomplished all of this. And through segregation, we were more adamant, you know what I'm saying, and we were more resilient in trying to provide for self. But as we begin to progress and people and get the ear of our people and show them a different perspective of how they can survive in this society, because the difference in the Nation of Islam and the Marcus Garvey movement is that the Nation of Islam believed wholeheartedly that the people here of color deserve a piece of this land. We had more rights to this land as any other immigrant that has come here before. And that was the difference, because the carve out, you know, in this society, a community that would cater to our needs to move forward as a people of color who had been deprived.
Sheikh Jabir, you want to make another point before we start this segment?
I apologize, sister, that law, it left my mind. I didn't take a note of it. But I'm sure it's going to come back. You were speaking of something that I should have taken a note. But it will come back because it's important. It's important.
No worries. Okay, so let's move forward. Last week you mentioned the culture of Islam in America. And understanding the culture of Islam. Now listen, I want to challenge that just a tad bit. Because we have a culture that we have worked hard for, and we just spoke about a few of those things here in this country with regard to Islam, and then you have the culture of Islam from an overseas perspective. So my challenge is, do not we have our own culture here in America? And should that integrate the culture of overseas, and to what level? Because to me, it should be limited. I'll give you my ideology on that.
Okay.
You may proceed with the answer of that question.
Right. Now, we talked about, of course, you know, the manifestation of Islam will take different forms and shapes, you know, to address whatever pressing issues they are. You know, if Islam was to go into a country that was being afflicted with poverty and things of that nature, then of course it would emphasize on economic development and how they can best utilize their resources to move out of that state of poverty. You know, that's very important. If Islam was in a monolithic society where everyone was of the same ethnic, you know, family, you know, they would deal with class and caste and nobility and things of that nature. So there would be areas in this Islamic doctrines that would address that. But the situation in America is there's no match. You know, I've searched for parallels in Islamic cultures and Islam going to different areas and spreading and so forth, but none of them seem to match the experience that we have went through and we're still experiencing in America to this day. We're talking about a people who came from African lands, lands that were replete with Muslims at that particular time, at least 30-40% of the people. If we do it by calculation, that ended up in captivity on the slave ships were Muslim. And when you come into a society that disallowed that, and you could even have your traditional cultural practice in America, you was forced to accept their belief system and so forth, and the way they presented it, not the belief system as it is presented in the scripture, but the way in which they interpreted their narrative and so forth. And they read into it that which gave them the advantage. Now, so and from that, an entire people was disenfranchised, And, you know, as a historian, as a sister mentioned, why that I choose history, and it's for many of these reasons. When I completed my education in the public schools, I never saw the word Islam in the history books. I never saw Muslims, Islamic personalities identified and isolated in my study of American history, U.S. history, so forth and so on. But when I began to look on the other side, you know, from books that are discarded or buried in the black bookstores, you know, things of that nature, I began to see a different perspective. And of course, when we look at that, the information of our experience has definitely been restricted to the Muslims from foreign lands. You know, they have been coming to and fro without having any interaction with people of color here, or even, you know, our institutions. And as you know, and I think I spoke about this last week, between 1878 and 1924, immigrants came from the Middle East, you know, from Syria, Lebanon, and Turkey, but they didn't come in as Muslims because they knew that if they came in as Muslims, it would have created a stigma, and they did not come in as Lebanese Syrians or Turks. They came in as whites, okay? And even though many of them were Muslim, they did not involve themselves with the grassroots indigenous Muslims, people of color, who had come by way of the African diaspora. It was like a line that you did not pass, because if you involve yourself, then there could have been some repercussions. Your status would have been lowered, and it was a great risk. So they established their cultural clubs and things like that, and they would practice their Islam behind walls, you know, their marriages, their ceremonies, and no one knew that they were around. They wouldn't even greet you or identify themselves as Muslims. And also the Anglo-Syrians that came here, they was actually, because, you know, Syria is an Arab country, but they did not allow anyone to come as an Arab. So you have to be an Anglo-Syrian, okay? And they were naturalized, you know, became American citizens, and they assimilated with the white racist fabric that was in the society. So based on the narrative, they had the same outlook on the people of color as those people who were in charge of your affairs and so forth and so on. So they definitely did not engage. They definitely did not engage. So that's why we see Islam being put together so very checkerboard-like, you know. It's very, you know, piecemeal, because they were looking, you know, we knew those who had made contact, and those who weren't afraid to give us a whisper in our ear who we were, they knew that Islam's supposed to be, you know, our choice of life. You know, when they compare that, you know, the principles of Islam, I'm not talking about the individuals, you know, but the principles of Islam and the individuals that was controlling our affairs, Islam seems to be a better choice. It seems to be a better choice, but we didn't have all the material. You know, I don't even think we had Qurans that was circulating, you know. In fact, the Qur'an was restricted, you know, in public places. That's why Nuruddin Ali, he presented the Circus 7, you know, as a mock for the Qur'an, you know, and so forth and so on. So now as we evolve and we go through the struggle, and we find that we have Islamic institutions been here, you know, the oldest mosque in America is 1929 in Ross, North Dakota, okay? But they were here when we was going through our struggle, but no one actually came forward to address the racism, the injustice, the discrimination from the Islamic perspective. So therefore, we had to develop a culture of resistance, you know. And it's amazing to say a culture of resistance, meaning that you have to educate yourself, you know what I'm saying, of the harms and the dangers that you may face, you know, in your life in the future, just by a person being a person of color. For no other reason, you would have a problem living in that society. So that within itself created a culture. It created an affinity and empathy towards people that look like yourself, because you could just imagine through that mirror reflection that they were going through the same hardships that you went through. And those people who were able to slip through the cracks, they had someone on the other side that pulled them through, or their resemblance with so much of that of the children of the masters that there was an empathy on that side to allow them to have some level of relief in the society. So yes, we had a culture. Now, when we talk about Islam as a faith and its principle, they say it's the same. But the way in which we navigate and we manifest our Islam is based on the circumstances and the conditions that we are under. If I went to a place like, for example, Sudan or Morocco, and I began to advocate, you know, my Islamic perspective as I see it in America, it would seem out of context. Okay, yes, it would seem out of context. And, you know, and vice versa. If someone would come from, say, Senegal or Sudan or Saudi Arabia or Turkey, you know, with their perspective of the Islamic narrative, it would seem out of context because it's not empowering the people. It would not address the very rudimentary needs that they're going through. It would not connect to the history, horrific history of a people who has been scarred that has come through that. So it would not be therapeutic enough to actually address the need. So definitely it would have to have people who actually was born in that society. You know, as the prophet said, the best leaders are those who've come from among you, the people who know, you know, the nuances that exist in the society. So I think a lot of times that we misunderstand Islam for diet, culture, festivities, and things that make it ceremonial stuff, as to looking at the what is Islam as a governance. You know, what is it that give people their own, that restores them their individual choice, you know, their humanity? And in spite and despite of our differences, there's a level of tolerance that we can find as Muslims.
Yes, sir. Fatima, your next question.
So the other question I wanted to ask then is that when you talk about how we descended from Africa and our faith and how a percentage was of those folks were Muslims, I guess what I want to also understand is how Christianity also factored in and how we became sort of one against the other. Because even like, you know, when we're talking about Christianity in America, it's definitely different than Christianity how it was in Africa. So can you expound on that a little bit also? Because it seems like there is two different sides who are sort of butting heads together to sort of say what faith, you know, my faith is better than your faith. When in fact, we're all sort of, you know, striving for the same thing, you know.
Right.
Can you expound on that just slightly? Thank you.
I did say that many people came here by way of the African diaspora that faced discrimination, racism, and so forth. But there were many people that were here that were indigenous to the land, you know, when the Europeans arrived here, who was actually socialized, you know, based on, you know, their phenology, their coloration. If they were, we call Native Americans for a better choice of word, if they were Native Americans who fitted the description of Africans, then they would re-socialize as Africans. You know, if they were Native Americans who could fit the description of Europeans, then they would re-socialize as whites. So there were indigenous people here who actually assimilated, you know, in the slave culture, and their blood mixed. You know, we have red blood and black skins today, and we have to also acknowledge that, you know, at least 75% of people beyond the Mason-Dixon line in America have an admixture of Native American inside of them. And that's why you don't see large numbers of red skins today, because the majority of them have been assimilated in the black skins. I just wanted to make that, you know, because we have a right, you know, to a piece of this land, you know, if it's going to be divided, you know, that's another issue. So we don't have to actually pack up anything and go nowhere, because we are just indigenous to this land, as Chief Sitting Bull or Geronimo or whatever. The second question is that when we talk about faith, Islam, Christianity, Judaism, it's not the faith itself that creates the conflict; it's the people of the faith. Because, you know, Christianity was in Ethiopia, you know, but it never was in West Africa until after the Emancipation Proclamation, they went back. It was the Christian king of Ethiopia who gave the first migrants of the followers of the Prophet Muhammad refuge when they actually crossed over there. It was a Christian in Egypt, St. Benjamin, who actually allied with Amr bin As, one of the companions and the commanding chief of the army, when they were trying to expel the Romans out of that land because of their oppression against the Christians. So I think that religion, you know, it depends on the people itself and what they are facing. The people of Egypt at that particular time, when Islam entered Egypt, had been ruled for over 1,000 years by foreigners. If it was not the Greeks, it was the Romans. If not the Romans, it was the Persians. So they didn't have any type of self-sovereignty until the Muslims came. And when the Muslims came, it was easy for them to identify with them because they was trying to get from under oppression, okay? And when you look at what the situation in America, you know, you find, you know, Christians, Jews, and Muslims. You know, we are faced with the same issues if you are a person of color based on the racial discriminatory laws that was actually levied against them. So naturally, they would come together for a common good, okay? And the faith itself would be actually not the primary issue at that particular time. But if you're in a society where everyone has the same ethnic origin, the same nationality, et cetera, then you would probably find religion would become a conflicting issue, as you find in some of the countries around the world that will have religious wars, like the wars of Bosnia, you know, things of that nature. They're the same people. The Turkish split, you have Muslims and Christians on one end. You have the Palestinian issue. You have, because they are fighting based on nationality or ethnicity, where religion impacts if they're the same ethnic group. In America, we find that we can identify, you know, with the civil rights movement, the Black Power movement, you know, the Black Empowerment movement. I like to address it like that because we are, as a people of color, while we have African diaspora or have native roots, are striving for the same thing. And if we, in fact, you know, cannot come together and identify that, then we will actually be at a stalemate. And that's what the powers want. They try to divide you on religion. Even though we're both trying to have what we call decent housing, decent neighborhoods, good health care, decent jobs, you know, we are still in the same social status as the people, but they will use religion and politics to divide the people, and we have to go beyond that if we're going to achieve a level of success.
Thank you, Imam Jafar. You bring up very important points. I'm going to take a minute. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent, Maraj C. I want to go back a little bit, Sheikh Jabir. We talked about Christianity. What Sister Fatima brought up is so poignant, especially in this society. And I want to touch on this a little. So let's go back to the Ansaris, you know, the Ethiopian community that welcomed the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, peace be upon him. And how Orthodox Christianity was presented by the slave master to the slaves. You know, there was a major detour, and I'm being polite here, right? From Orthodox Christianity. In fact, where slaves were weren't even allowed to read the scripture of the Bible.
True.
So this is a presentation they brought to the slaves versus Orthodox Christianity. If you can go on the historic passages of those two entities, please.
Yes. It's when you look at the Ethiopian Christianity, the system of fairness, justice, all of the scriptural regulations were applied. You know, if you look at the very early stages of Islam, you know, when the Prophet had his first epiphany, it was his wife's uncle, a cousin, who came to him, who was a Christian. When he went to Damascus as a youngster, it was Bahira, a Christian monk, who recognized his prophethood. When he went to Medina on the migration, it was Christians there who embraced you know, it protected him and embraced the congregation of Muslims and made the Prophet, peace and blessing be upon him, the arbitrator between disputes there. Now, something that's very unique about the migration from Mecca to Abyssinia or Ethiopia at that time, as we know historically, the Abyssinians had ruled Arabia, southern Arabia, for nearly 400 years. And we have a chapter in the Quran called the Chapter of the Elephant, which was actually applied to Abraha, who was the actual general of the Christian army. And it was only until the Persians expelled the Abyssinians out of southern Arabia that the Arabs gained control over their land. Now, there were, in fact, more Arab slaves in Arabia than there were Ethiopian slaves. This is another something that we don't know, that Ethiopians were a very powerful nation, and they only lost that power when they were defeated by the Persians, and that's why you find Ethiopian slaves in Arabia at that time. It was not something that was a cultural norm for Arabs to enslave Ethiopians. In fact, it was vice versa. The Ethiopians would enslave the Arabs because they were more powerful as a people. But there was so much enmity and animosity between the Arabs and the Ethiopians because of the fact that they had you know, decades of conflict. But the silver lining that gave the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessing be upon him, trust was the fact that they had a king in Ethiopia. He was of Christian orientation, and the Prophet knew him to be a just ruler. So without question, he sent his people there with a letter. And what is unique about that letter, he said that he proclaimed himself as the messenger of Allah to the king, and he invited the king to Islam. And he said, I bear witness, and he made it clear his position with Jesus. You know, I bear witness that Jesus is a messenger and a servant of Allah, and he went through the narrative. And he received his refugees, and he gave them asylum there, okay, because they were applying, or that particular king applied the rules of justice as it is in their text. Now, when we come to the American situation, you know, the fact that you couldn't read, you could not critique what your master was saying. So they taught you passages of the Bible wherein the slave, which was actually a Roman a paradigm of slavery, that a slave should be obedient to his master. They isolated passages. They gave it to the reverends, those who could read a little bit, and this is what they would teach the slave, that you know, your lot was something that was divine, and that who you are as a person is being decreed by God, and the people who are over you, they have that right, and they introduce what we call the mythological curse of Ham, you know, that the blacks should be servants unto their brothers and so forth and so on. And that went well because you couldn't read or write. You know, to be a captive, you know, is different from someone who's born into slavery. So from the very birth of these children, they were taught to be submissive. They were taught to obey their masters. They had accepted the fact that they were an inferior people. That's why Harriet Tubman said, if they had only knew they were slaves, I could have freed 1,000 more. So now, wow, when you have people that break the ice, you see, like Marcus Garvey, Nobutu Ali, Elijah Muhammad, Professor Ezzedine Muhammad, Malcolm X, it goes on and on. I mean, there's just so many people. You know, we just find, and I always think the heroes are never recorded. That's my position. You know, I mean, the heroes are the ones who come home from the battle, but we never commemorate those who we left in the graves on the battlefield. So there were so many people that did not get caught up in their matrix, that could see through that. You know, like Frederick Douglass, by him learning to read, had a different mind state, you know. And then you look at the educated class of people coming out of slavery. They were the problems, you know, because once a person have knowledge of something, it's very hard to contain them. And I think that's one reason why, and I know this question is going to come up again, why that they're suppressing black literature inside of the school system, because they don't want to reveal their hypocrisy, their unfairness. I mean, when you look at the fabric of American history, it's demonic in the way they treated another human being. And and they don't want anyone to actually revisit that. And that's where we're at today in regards to that type of situation.
Very good. Sister Fatima, your next question. Thank you.
So, okay, following up on what I asked earlier about just Malcolm and his and the break that happened. So, because I think that there's also, as it relates to that, the fact that there was forces within and without in terms of wanting Malcolm out of the way. You had the FBI, boss, and NYPD. So again, I just want to make sure I'm clear on how do those organizations infiltrate, like organizations like the Nation of Islam, and how did that, I guess, culminate in obviously Malcolm becoming assassinated? So, because obviously the people who killed him were, I think some of them were affiliated with one or more of these organizations, correct or no?
Well, there's allegations. You know, no one really, you know, we just got smoking guns at the end of the day. But when you look at the, it's very easy to infiltrate, you know, and,
right.
You know, one thing is, you know, as a forensic historian, Sister Salima, is that, you know, you're always sitting in the hot seat, that you have to evaluate, you know, every piece of literature that comes across your desk, and it's all based on the intent. You know, you have to look beyond the letters and say, what is the intent behind what is being presented? So it's very easy to infiltrate. You know, you just take the autobiography of Malcolm X, you know, as told by Malcolm, but I say as told by Alex Haley, told to Alex Haley by Malcolm. But at the end of the day, Alex Haley, he told his story. So here you have a catalog of information, you know, about intricate. We don't know what Malcolm actually told him in total. We just know what he chose to actually put in the book. You understand my point? So there was volumes and pages of information that probably wasn't acceptable for the publisher. Okay, but this information can be shared with law enforcement agencies and things like that. So it's very easy to penetrate. You could be in the U.S. Army. You can be in any law enforcement branch, any defense branch in America, and you can have your choice of religion, you know, or you can choose your own social club. So it's very easy to infiltrate. And as you know, the people that get the closest to you are the most suspectable people, you see. So it's very easy. You look at we have the President of the United States of America, John F. Kennedy, 1963, was assassinated. I mean, no protection. You know, if you go through the files and things like that, you know, we have to conclude it was a conspiracy based on the nature in which he was assassinated. But that was, you know, a planned event. And the people that can carry out such a task have to be someone, you know, of high authority. So when you look at the situation of Haj Manisha Bass, as I said, you know, the FBI files did not start chasing or investigating Malcolm when he broke away from the Nation. It was a continuum, you know. It was a continuum. In fact, the plan was to actually demolish the Nation altogether and all of its factors, whether it was a splinter group or it was consolidated. They wanted it off the map because people was waking up. You know, people was waking up. People, I am a human being. So the way that law enforcement agencies work is that, you know, no one, you know, wants to be involved with a white, you know, they want to end up at the end of the day with white gloves. Nobody, you know, hands is on. But to pull back security, to be able to instigate, to embellish those who was in opposition, as I mentioned, there were some people from an emotional standpoint, you know, regardless of the orders that came from the headquarters not to touch Malcolm, they were the ones, well, we're going to do this anyway. But when you have money, you have bribes, if you can get an exemption, you know, from something that may be pending on you, then people do all kinds of things. So the infiltration is very easy, you know. If they look like you, walk like you, and talk like you, then, you know, you assume they're of you, you know. And this is the point that a lot of people don't want to look at, sister. They don't want to look at those people who were actually close to Malcolm, like right in his inner circle. You know, is it possible they had some involvement, you know, and how this thing was concealed and how they was able to divert that. You know, this is something that's traditional in our Islam. The Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, had a very faithful companion by the name of Hudhayfa, and he would confide in Hudhayfa the secrets that he wouldn't tell any other companion. And he told Hudhayfa, or he gave him a list of the hypocrites that was in his congregation. And Hudhayfa did not share that with anyone. And Umar, the second caliph, would always go to Hudhayfa and ask him these questions, and Hudhayfa would not tell him. So Umar would watch the people who die and see if Hudhayfa would pray over them, because we can't pray over a hypocrite, okay? So I'm saying that to say that it's very hard to find out or to see the manner in which they infiltrated. And we know the agenda at the end was to eliminate opposition, okay? Was to eliminate. It's no coincidence that Marcus Garvey was deported, you know what I'm saying? It's about eliminating opposition. And what happened is, as we identify with splinter groups, we take sides. We can't see the big picture, okay? We actually, our conviction is on the small guy, you see? You know, our condemnation is on the small guy, you know, who may have been coerced, you know, who may have been bribed, you know, who may have been paid to carry out a task, okay? And may have been assured that he or she would be protected, you know, in the end results of the affair.
You know, Sheikh Jabir, you bring up some very formidable points. Let's talk about the women. I remember specifically last week we touched on Dr. Betty Shabazz, the wife of Malcolm X, and Sister Clara Muhammad, the wife of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and talk about their contributions of the women in Islam in North America and the sacrifices,
man,
not only the brothers went through, but the sisters went through, the wives went through, as we move forward in our consciousness. If
wow.
You would, please.
You know, it, people don't realize that, you know, the women, you know, and there's a proverbial statement behind every good man is a strong woman. And we know that what the males are going through as men, the women are going through the same process as women. You know, it takes a special person to deal with a leader, you know, Sister Clara Muhammad, you know, knowing that any moment she could be a widow. I mean, it's like we live in from minute to minute because of the opposition and the scrutiny and slander, you know, just all types of, you know, the way you destroy a man, the first effort is to go through his wife. Okay, that is the first strategy to destroy a person's credibility, to destroy their strategies, just to break the will, okay? And if you find women who can stand the test of time, who can see the mission, you can see the movement, can see the big picture, you know, then that takes a person with special character, you know, and, you know, the time. I mean, you know, I'm an imam and also a speaker, I would have to commemorate my wife for being as patient as she is in my absence, you know. I mean, just being absent, you know, and same with Betty, you know, to endure, you know, to maintain herself and her dignity as a woman, you know, under all of those hardships and difficulties and raising children and so forth. It takes a tremendous person to do that. To finish the race, you know, and with the nation, a lot was going on. I mean, you know, you're talking about a person, Elijah Muhammad's life being threatened. I mean, we don't get the, you know, we just got the FBI file for a few years back. I mean, we don't you know, he was the most wiretap person in the history of American investigation of organizations. I mean, you know, that nation was, I mean, it was almost like on the satellite 24/7, okay? And it takes a very wise person to be able to navigate under those circumstances. And I think that his wife, you know, was his backbone, you know? She was his rib, you know? She was there. It takes a tremendous woman, you know, to do stuff like that, to stand behind, you know, with the same risk factor and so forth. And as we know, a lot of things come in with relationships. That's the first cliff that they see that they can get through to try to destroy. And their intent is not to destroy the relationship. They're trying to destroy the movement itself, you know. And I think they deserve, you know, at least a high level of recognition for their continuation of support for their leaders. And again, we don't see the contributions that's made because it's not overtly, you know, the advice, you know, the condolence, sometimes, you know, the wife, the spouse is your confidant. That's the closest companion that you have. And, you know, they become closer than a mother, a father, a son, or a daughter, or anyone, because you are so emotionally entwined and entangled with them that is your echo. And the way they receive it and the way they respond determines how much strength you draw from them. So they were an energizer for them to go forward.
Yes, I look at the contributions of Brother Minister Farrakhan, Sister Khadija Farrakhan. Fatima, you made a good point earlier. Okay, when you talked about Islam being perceived as a fundamentalist, and we know our brother Minister Farrakhan is perceived as that, but that is certainly not his orientation.
Oh, I know, but I wanted him to be able to clarify that.
Saying that was a good point you brought up. I thought it was very important.
Thank you.
You know, and as we continue, so Sheikh Jabril, let's talk about how we continue. Where are we today?
Yeah, that's why we had a question.
Go ahead, Fatima.
No, I was going to lead into that. Like, okay, so now we know what happened in the 60s and the 50s, and, you know, a lot of our leaders were killed off. When you think about Medgar Evers, and you think about Malcolm X, and you think about Martin Luther King. So I guess the question I have is, okay, today how do we move forward with that? Because, you know, one of the things that Martin said is, you know, in terms of segregation, it was that he was afraid that we were segregating into a burning house. So in a sense, you know, segregation in a lot of ways, as far as how it impacted the black community, was not always a positive thing.
You
so
said
I guess,
segregation or can you say you said
I said segregation. Correct. We've been segregating into the school system, segregated into communities, because there was a sense that we lost our resolve for black empowerment when that happened. Because even when we grew up, you know, our dad, we grew up in, it's more or less an inner city, although our mother grew up in the South. And, you know, we grew up in an area that was, you know, very, very strong in terms of black identity, black culture, black community. Now you don't have that as much. So I guess my question is, how do we move forward now that we did have a lot of these leaders silenced, if you will, and that a lot of us are now segregated and taking on a lot of, you know, attributes of our oppressor, quite frankly. We want the not fancy houses. I'm not saying we shouldn't have those things, but at what cost? To our own sort of our sense of black empowerment.
Gotcha. Thank you.
And let me piggyback before you start. Thank you. Excuse me. Let me piggyback on that. You know, you're talking about an issue here, but then how do we empower ourselves in the deen, in the faith, in the process of bringing Allah into our lives on a daily basis? Because you can't separate Allah from any of these issues.
Mm-mm.
You may proceed.
That's right. Yes. Wow, that's a lot. You know, I was just, you know, this morning looking at my computer. Because, you know, we're doing the movie, I Buried Malcolm. And I was just looking at my father and Minister Farrakhan in Mecca together performing the Hajj on Mount Arafat. I have that's the first time Minister Farrakhan went to Arafat to perform the Hajj. And I was just, you know, like reminiscing, going back, looking at some of my old footage. And a lot of people don't even know that. And that's the only footage that we have. And this was done in the 80s because at that particular time, you could not take a camera into the Holy Precincts to do any footage. But the fact that my father was working for Islamic Press International, he was given a pass. So him and Minister Farrakhan spent the Hajj together, and they had some serious dialogue, okay? And I'm saying that because you talked about where we go from here. And the movie, I Barrett Malcolm, is actually Life After the Grave. What is the continuum of that? After all of said and done, where are we at Muslims? Ali Muslim, Masjid Muhammad 25 in Newark on Springfield Avenue, has been implemented in a lot of those issues as an outpost. It was in my father and Imam Ali Muslim, may Allah be pleased with him, both of them, conducted the first unified Eid, okay, when Imam Wahdi Muhammad transformed, the Nation of Islam to Orthodox Islam to that degree. We found a common ground to come and do things together. And I'm saying that to say that if we can find commonality to work together, we need to build institutions. We need to empower ourselves economically. And again, I think that, and when I look hindsight, when I look at the South and the North, the people in the South actually have more resources than the people in the North, people of color. My grandmother and her family had over 1,000 acres of land. I grew up on a full-fledged farm. We were the only people in the county that slaughtered beef, as dietary consumption. There was bus companies in Winston-Salem. We had our own manufacturing company, our newspaper. I mean, I'm saying to say that when you are forced to do for self, then all of the talents, come forward. All of the people that have the expertise begin to contribute. And our resources are channeled to the point that we benefit from them. So as where we are as Muslims today, I think that we can build, Sister Salima, 1,000 masjids. We can build 2,000 masjids. But who going to go there to pray? But we got to build communities. Most people, when they go to Juma, they have to drive 40 to 50 minutes, an hour to get from their residence to the place of their prayer. You know what I'm saying? So that's not community. We live in neighborhoods, but we haven't developed a community where we know one another. You see what I'm saying? Where our sons and daughters are so familiar with one another that when they get ready to get married, they know the character and personality and the mannerism of the person they have an interest in. Communities eliminate us being strangers. I think that it's the Muslim community as a whole. Not as a group or an organization or a facet of Islam, but if we as Muslim as a whole can come together with a comprehensive agenda that will move all of us forward. Like you said, Islam is here to stay, and Islam is going to be the way it is, but we have to manifest, our Islam based on the circumstances that we are facing today. We have to be on equal footing. The strength of the dawah and the invitation of Islam is when you are independent of those who you're inviting. Okay? You want to be the person who is offering a benefit as opposed to receiving, you see? And I think that that's the problem that we have, that we're running into. Once upon a time, we were a very influential entity in the society. We were a factor to contend with. If you said you was a Muslim in anywhere in America, you was worthy of respect.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Yes, sir.
But unfortunately today, that we are praying over our sons, in janazas because they are being consumed by the negative culture which we had removed ourselves from. They have went back to that. And we have a lot of problems. Why? Because we haven't built anything in the last 20, 30, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't built, and when I say, I'm talking about institutions that, that empower people, that launch paths, that give them purpose in life. And that's what we need to do as Muslims. And I think that what has happened, unfortunately, you know, is that we have laid down, you know, our tools. And we are looking for just the spirituality of Islam, you know, a nice masjid, you know, someone who can deliver a nice sermon. And we have fallen into that church-state mentality. When Islam is comprehensive, you know, it has to engulf and regulate our entire life. You see what I'm saying? From our birth until our death, you know, so that's the problem that we have. You know, we have no longer sit at the table with the economic developers, you know, with our social scientists, you know, with our politicians. We're just listening to the clergy, just the religious personality who are telling us to stay away from this and to indulge in this. So our life has been restricted to what we call ecclesiastic rituals, formalism. There's no substance that's placed inside of that, and we have to get back to that. It's not no disrespect to society we live in, but we have to do for self. We have to make sure that we're going to survive as a people. You know what I'm saying? That our Islamic identity has to continue. You see what I'm saying? Because if we continue in the route in which we're going through this mass assimilation where we're giving up our principles, we're giving up our values, we're giving up the mission, then at the end of the race, we will be at the end.
You know, this is profound. I recall hearing Imam Warisuddin Muhammad when asked a question about building masjids, and the Imam replied, build schools and you can always pray in the schools.
Yes. Yes. You know, institutions, you know, like the prophet said, the whole earth is a masjid, you know? I mean, meaning that and see, this is the problem. You know, like I said, we grew up and my family, we had over 1,000 acres of land. And I'm sad to say, sister, that I don't have an acre of that land. You know, because everybody moved north and they moved to west and, you know, they was going for the city lights. But, you know, the cities are just, you know, jungles with street lights and it's the same, you know. And we didn't have a plan we didn't have a plan to develop that. We had in the community I come from, the Dinullahi Universal Arabic Association, we had Islamic communities, farmland. We built our own houses and everything. You know, water and wells, et cetera. But today, those we still have 325 acres in Buffalo, New York, but it's just land with no inhabitants. So we have to come back to that mentality, that mind state, that if we are going to survive as a community, okay, we're going to have to start building again.
Yes, Fatima. Sister Fatima, do you have another question?
Yes, I just wanted to sort of, because I know we're getting ready to run out of time, I just wanted to know who has influenced the Sheikh primarily in his life. I know obviously his dad did, but I also wanted to know who else influenced him to lead, basically to lead him down the path in terms of his own journey. Like, who was your biggest influencers?
Wow, you know, of course my father. And my mother and my grandmother. It's family, but when, you know, it's unique that you said that and interesting because, you know, my father, you know, we talked about, you know, being strong as a wife. You know, you have to also be strong as a son because when your father is your teacher, you know, your mentor and your guide, and he's the deciding factor in many of your choices, you know, it's only moments that you see that father, that daddy, in that person, you know, and you cherish those moments, you know, and when you go back and look at the pictures and things like that and photos, you look for that daddy, you know. Sometimes you want to get around the teacher, you know. In fact, I call my father Sheikh. I call him Abu sometimes, but it's just a title of reverence and honor, you know, Sheikh. But yes, you know, I'm a reader. You know, I looked at, you know, as a child in school, all the black personalities like Frederick Douglass and Sir John F. Truth, you know, Nat Turner, all of these were my heroes. You know, these was like, you know, when I can remember when black history was introduced in the school system, you know. And I've heard this as, you know, as a Muslim, but I didn't see anything but us. You know what I'm saying? You know, kind of like an isolated world, you know. But when I began to read about this, it, like, inspired me. So I just, then I want to know about Marcus Garvey. And I took from every one of them because there's a silver lining. We talk about justice, freedom, equality, you know. There's a silver lining that I saw in all of them, okay? And then, you know, the works, you know, as an influence, my father, yeah, but as I matured in life, I began to take from a lot of people, you know, just bits and pieces that and I created the puzzle, you know, and the puzzle is still not complete because I'm a grandfather now, and I got to make sure that my grandchildren, you know, are secured in to the best of their ability. But everywhere that I heard Allah's name mentioned, you know, I always visited that place. You know, I was like a person who lived a long portion of my life, non-discriminatory. Okay, I sat with everybody, whether you Sufi, Shia, the Nation of Islam, the Ansar, you know,
wow.
I mean, Tabliki. Mm. I mean, I just wanted to know, you know, what is this thing about? Mm. And then I looked at the whole picture. I said, you know, the things that divide us are less important than the things that should bring us together.
Sure.
You know, and I can remember the nephew of the Prophet Ali, peace and may Allah be pleased with him. He said that I'd rather to be united, right? I'd rather be united on half truth and half wrong than to be divided on all truth. On all
truth. Yeah. Profound.
So what are we going to do? You know, with all the information, you know, the reason why I can sit and talk, you know, with diversity because the way my father orientated me. He said everything is a growth process, you know. You cannot live yesterday, okay? You can remember it, but you can't live it. But you got to put your sights on tomorrow. And that's what I'm trying to do with my history. Is to put and bring people out of that crab bag, you know, because like I said, sometimes if we revisit situations with wrong information or misinformation, we actually open up wounds that have long been closed. Yeah, long been closed, and that impedes us. And a lot of people they do it purposely so that we don't grow. Some people don't want to grow out of their comfort zone, you know. And some people, if you allow them, they will hold you in that little, you know, cubby comfort zone, and everyone else will move forward. And I'm definitely, I'm about to be an inclusive. I'm about looking at the bigger picture. I'm about finding common ground where we can actually be victorious.
So I have one final question.
Okay, hold on, Fatima. We're going to get to your question, but before we leave today, Sheikh Jabir, after Fatima's next question, and make note of this, I want to review some of I Buried Malcolm documentary when that's going to be released, a compelling story that's never been told. Just give us a synopsis of how cathartic this work has been for you. And we will end with that. But Fatima, you go ahead with your question, Sister Fatima.
Okay, thank you. So my final question is this. Since we are behind the eight ball, so to speak, in terms of not building anything, obviously in order to do that, you need what? Resources. You need money. So with that in mind, do you support reparations?
I support reparations if the outline, if it's lined it up correctly, you know, because when we say reparation, we're talking about someone being recreated, giving back what has been taken, making a proper assessment, and how it will be. In general, yes, I do. I think that if we do not get, you know, a certain amount of resources, we can't compete with corporate America on this level. I mean, we can dream. Mm-hmm. We can dream. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have different people who may excel. You know, we have people that are billionaires. We have, you know, people that are millionaires, but their money is clamped inside of corporate America. And there's actually is also discretion that's been placed on how they use that money. So as a whole, we can't rely on a few people to actually empower us. But there's a debt due, okay? There's a debt due. However it's going to play out, I don't know. But I definitely think that the debt has to be taken care of in order for the people to get some level of, you know, comfort in the society, because we're disenfranchised. I mean, any person, I don't know, everybody have their opinion, but I don't think that the way that society is moving, that one segment of the society will actually create a equilibrium with another set. I've seen in my lifetime people come from foreign lands. I mean, I have nothing against Hispanics and Asians and nothing. You know, they're human beings. But they come right in from grassroots and they go to the top, you know, with all kinds of assistance. But the people who have been here and have been disenfranchised, mm-hmm. and labor has been extracted from our ancestors at a wholesale level, are being deprived, denied, and overlooked. We cannot persist in this state and think that we're going to have some level of equilibrium and a level of respect and dignity in society until we are economically empowered. People can say what they want to say, but if you want to, you know, even in warfare, you got to have a superior weapon to be victorious. You know, and that's how I see it, that in order to really build at the level we really need to build, we're going to have to actually petition this government. That's the next movement, you know what I'm saying? We had the civil rights movement, you know, and the human rights movement. Now it's about the economic movement.
You know, before we go into our Barry Malcolm document, I wanted to comment. I was reading an article yesterday. It was very interesting. This opportunity is here. It may be obscure, but it is here. And this article was talking about corporate buildings, skyliners, skyscrapers, as a result of the pandemic. So we're going into a new era that are empty. They can't build them up. And this is not only in America. Japan, I think it's Japan and China, has stopped architectural buildings of skyscrapers because they don't have the same use that they had decades ago. So this is new opportunity. So this is coming back down to what? Grassroots, right? This is coming back down to what? Community, right? So I just wanted to piggyback on that and say, you know, how things are changing as a result of current circumstances, and it does present new opportunity. I Barry Malcolm documentary. Shake Jabir, if you can just give us an overview on how exciting this has been, how cathartic this has been, and tell our listening audience what this is about generically.
Yes. Wow. I Barry Malcolm. You know, it's my father. He actually did the film for Malcolm, and there was a lot of circumstances that, a lot of issues that he had to go through to get to that point. As you know, the climate was very hostile at that particular time, and so he wrote the book. And in the book, you know, he kind of explains his role in that barrier process, but what happens is he had a legacy that continued, and that's the name of the movie, I Barry Malcolm, The Final Chapter. And the final chapter means that, okay, we have to accept what has happened and move forward, okay, pick up the pieces and move forward. Now, what is the work that has been done after Malcolm? Okay, that's important. You know, we don't want to go into stalemate because, you know, everybody has pulled on Malcolm and everybody has the opinion of Malcolm and so forth and so on. But what is the work that's being carried on after Malcolm, you see? And you see, that's what the book is about, you know, his legacy, you know, what he did in the area of Dawa, you know, going into South Africa, 200 Zulus took the Shahada. He was in the 1967
a current report for social disobedience, social disorder. I mean, he did the barrier for Betty Shabazz. He worked 20 years for the Muslim World League. He went to almost every Muslim country in the world. He interviewed the heads of state at every level. And we are trying to see what happened is that a lot of our younger Muslims coming up don't know that we have boots on the ground, people that have made great contributions to Islam, you know, and a lot of people are actually riding off of this success, you know, and we're looking more so at its immigrant Islamic manifestation as the real Islam, you know, like this is where Islam, this is what we have to adjust to now. You know what I'm saying? But we have a missed beat in our work into calling people into Islam and to working diligently hand in hand to bridge the gap in our differences and finding common ground. And I was like I mentioned a few things where my father was in made pilgrimage with Farrakhan. That's what was found, you know. And no one knows about that, you know. We had the first United Eve. He interviewed Imam Wazi Muhammad. And then we'll have mercy on him numerous times. They have had numerous conversations about Islam, moving, working together on this funding platform and so forth. No one knows about our work. And I started now from the legacy of Haji Sham Jab includes all those people who are actually doing work today in Islam, as he, you know, cross-sected them and so forth and so on. So that's what it's about, bringing a live history to our people so that they can identify within.
I think you're on mute, Sheikh. You're on mute, Sheikh Jabrir. You're still on. And maybe your hold button or your mute button.
Yeah, I lost him too. I don't hear him.
You don't hear him. I don't hear him either.
Yeah.
We are coming to the end of this show. And I want, and if he's still showing in my rotation as being on, so he may be on mute, or let me take a pause here because we could do this. This is our show to, because I would like for him to complete. Let's see. To the listening audience, we're just going to pause here for a few minutes as we're trying to get Sheikh Jabrir back in. We are still on pause here. Sometimes we have these difficulties, these technical difficulties, but I really want him to be able to finish his commentary.
What's going on?
We're trying to get Sheikh Jabrir back in to the studio. Just give us a few minutes here. And Sister Fatima, I still have you, correct?
You do. I'm still here. Just waiting
okay,
to see the documentary. This is a documentary that is coming out, I understand, correct? And he has directed, okay. Wonderful. I would love to hear
okay.
more about that.
So we're going to try to get him back here into the studio. And I'm doing that as we speak.
Hello?
Oh, you're back. We have you.
Yes.
Fatima, you're still here?
I am.
Okay, beautiful. Sheikh, go ahead and finish your commentary.
Okay, I would disconnect. I was speaking of the purpose of the movie is to actually show the work that's being carried on after the death of Haj Malik Shabazz. My father actually entering into history by performing that historical janaza, kind of like put him, you know, he was already the national imam for the AUAA, but it kind of like put him in the spotlight. So his life has been actually recorded as works and so forth for the last 40 years. So we actually documented that. And it's actually his life includes all the Muslims that has, they're still doing work. As I mentioned, he performed the pilgrimage with Mr. Louis Farrakhan. He and Imam Wazi Muhammad, may Allah have mercy on him, had many interviews, you know, and dialogue about, you know, the future of Islam in America. Masjid Muhammad 20 on Springfield Avenue, we performed the first United Eid there. He organized that with Imam Ali Muslim, showing working relationship, trying to find common ground. 20 years with the Robert the Muslim World League, giving out scholarships, you know, for Muslims to go abroad to study Islamic sciences and so forth. Just his life with Islamic Press International, traveling around the world into Soweto, South Africa, on Randall's Island when Nelson Mandela was incarcerated, 200 Shahadas to the Zulu Nation. All of this work shows that there's people, you know, of indigenous Muslim orientation that's doing work. And I think that it is an inspiration for the younger Muslims to look at, you know, a continuum as opposed to actually reinventing the wheel, try to find, you know, where you can fit in to contribute to the growth of Islam. And this is the purpose of the movie, his life and his legacy and so forth, and the continuous work that's going on through his progeny.
And then you have a GoFundMe page, if you would direct the listening audience to that, please.
Yes, it's GoFundMe, I Barrett Malcolm. And we're trying to get, you know, funding to actually purchase the clips and, you know, and with technology now, we have most of our recordings of our fathers on the beta, the VHS and so forth. We've got to get all of that converted to MP4 files for footage. We've got to purchase rights for stock footage. But we want to really bring something to the public that really reflects us and our history as Muslims, you know, not leaving anyone out, and actually identifying the positive aspects of what we've done over, you know, 80-some-odd years as Islam revived itself in our culture when everyone had abandoned us, you know, and left us, you know, whether they had, it was through compulsion or whether it was through their own choice, it, the fact still remains that we were left out to dry, you know. So we want to actually bring all these pieces back together in this documentary, I, Barrett Malcolm, the final chapter, The Legacy of Haj Hisham Jabbar. You can go to GoFundMe, I, Barrett Malcolm, and inshallah, your contribution will serve as a reward as Sadaqa Jariyah, you know, perpetual charity.
Thank you so much. Oh, it has been a treat. It has been a pleasure. Sheikh Jabir, your final thoughts.
Well, again, Sister Salima, I really appreciate the opportunity for you bringing me on this platform. I think that we need more of this. You know, I think that what you're doing is great. And, you know, my brother Murad is definitely a plus. You know, he's in our prayers and he's really, really brought a lot of Muslims together. You know, and I think this is one of this is a manifestation of that, that he's a person who's he's inclusive and he looks at the bright side, and that podcast and this radio broadcast that he has, you know, he's a part of is something that's going to benefit, you know, a lot of Muslims. And definitely I like to come back, you know, and whenever you find slots and we can just have, you know, a general conversation, you know, I have to always be structured around my life and my
yes,
life. But I like to be,
sir.
I like
yes,
to hear, listen as well, definitely. So thank you for having me.
By all means, and two, when the movie is launched, we can come back and discuss that too specifically, but definitely as a guest, you know, for a roundtable where we can have community talks, you know, because we have a community to continue building, Sister Fatima, thank you for your prolific questions and thoughts. Your final thoughts.
You're welcome, and thank you as well. It's been my pleasure to be a part of this discussion and an honor. So really thank you for inviting me and allowing me to be a part of it. So I look forward to be participating in the future. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you to the listening audience. We thank you for tuning in today. This program is sponsored by New Africa Excellent, Maraj Speaks. Fatima, do you have a contact number if anyone wants to contact you? You have a DIY 365. We're going to have you back on to discuss the launch of your new programming. Is there an email that the listeners can contact you?
Anyone can contact me at my Gmail account as of right now. We're still in the process of building our web presence and for DIY 365, so that should be coming in the very, very near future. We're hoping to launch second quarter of 2022. But in the meanwhile, anyone can reach me at FatimaIAli@gmail.com.
Thank you so much. You can reach me at Salima, S-A-L-I-M-A-H-M-O-H-77. @gmail.com. Thank you to my listening audience. Thank you to my guests. Have a wonderful rest of your day. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam.